Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hello, welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name's Jamie.
My name's Caitlin.
And this is our podcast where we talk about women in the movies.
Yeah, that is exactly what it is. And it's inspired by the Bechdel test.
Right.
If you're not familiar with that, it's
get
a test.
Get a life.
Yeah, throw yourself into a river.
Walk in the traffic.
or you can just learn from us, because we're about to tell you that it's a test that you apply to movies that requires that there are two female characters. They speak to each other. They have names, and their conversation cannot be about a man.
Do you want to do a demo really quick?
I'd love to.
Okay, so here's an example of something that went past the Bechdel test. Caitlin, do you think that Meryl Streep is happy?
Jamie, what is happiness? You know, who am I to say whether or not Meryl Streep is happy?
Meryl who?
What did I say?
Meryl Streep. So that's an example of passed the Bechdel test, because we didn't talk about a man. We talked about esteemed actress Meryl Streep.
But what if Meryl Streep is a man and I fucked it up?
No, it's wrong.
I know Meryl Streep is a woman.
Meryl Streep. We don't know how they identify.
Right.
Right. We don't want to put Meryl Streep in a box. I wonder if Meryl Streep has seen Doubt. When are we going to do a Doubt episode?
Soon.
Okay.
Soon.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, let's pretend that Meryl Streep is a woman that conversation definitely passed the Bechdel test.
I'm about to break the Bechdel test. I've got a Mike's Harder lemonade in blood orange today.
Wow.
Yeah, it tastes like Tang with trash in it. Oh. It's good. It's good, though. It's good. Hey, do you want to have an episode?
I'd love to.
Let's have an episode.
Okay, let's introduce our guest. He is a co-creator and co-star of the upcoming show Corporate on Comedy Central.
It's so good. You can watch the first four eps now.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's Jake Wiseman.
Hey.
Hi.
Wow. What's up?
Oh, not too much. How about you?
Loving the Meryl Streep stuff.
I know.
That was a real giggle.
Working out a street
bit. Had to stifle some giggles there.
Yeah, a live stifle. If you're out there, Meryl Streep, find me on Twitter. Let's be friends.
We'll send you something. We don't have any merchandise. We'll send you something. It doesn't matter.
We got to get merch.
I still have my hamster's corpse in the freezer. I'll send you that. Does anyone want that? Yeah, I've actually been struggling with what to do with it.
How often do you touch it?
About once a day.
Yeah.
Just to check it's...
But it's in a bag, right?
It's in a ball in a bag in the freezer.
Wait, what do you mean in a ball?
Like a hamster ball.
Oh, it's in a ball in a bag.
In a bag so that my roommates don't see that there's a hamster corpse in the freezer.
Do they listen to this podcast?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, yeah.
They certainly don't. So now I have to decide. I'm torn between taxidermy and Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and I've been putting it off for almost 3 weeks now, and I don't know how long you can keep a corpse in your freezer.
Well, from experience, I'd say up to. I don't know. I'm not a murderer.
No, I was really on board for taxidermy, but then now I don't want my hamster's passing to be a joke. I loved her.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to just bury her next to Zsa Zsa Gabor, like my original plan was.
So wait, are you gonna pay to bury it? You're just gonna go in there and just fucking do it?
Yeah, I just need to find someone to go with me, and I'll bring like a spoon, and then just bury her somewhere.
I'll go.
Yeah. Okay, come with.
All right.
It'll be so fun.
I think I'm busy, but it sounds great.
They're unbelievable. No time specified. Okay, fine. So what are we, what's the podcast?
We're talking today about Pulp Fiction.
This is the second
Tarantino
film we've done, right?
What was the first one you did?
We did Kill Bill. That was our first episode ever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well,
yeah.
A woman is the lead of that.
Yes.
Yep.
So this is different.
This is a little bit different. Tell us when you first saw this or what your history with this movie is.
I think this movie came out in 94, if I believe. And so I would have been 11. I do remember specifically when it came out, it was all the rage. It was a phenomenon. I remember wanting to see it so badly and just pestering my dad to see it. And he had already seen it. Everyone was talking about how great it was. And he's like, we're going to the movies, but we can't see Pulp Fiction. You're too young to see it. We're going to see Nobody's Fool instead. Now, Nobody's Fool is a film starring Paul Newman and Melanie Griffith. I've seen it, and it actually is a good movie, but I was such a brat. I was an 11-year-old prick, and I was like, no, it's not fair. You're not going to let me see Pulp Fiction. I'm adult enough. And I remember he took me to the movies. He's like, come on, we're going to the movies. And I was in the backseat just whining. And we got to the window, and one of the best moments of my life, I remember vividly, he goes, 2 for Pulp Fiction. And I was like, oh my God, amazing long play. Now, here's the thing. I was definitely too young to see it, and he made a mistake. Like he's a bad dad.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
11-year-old that's why I'm so fucked up. But it was cool to see it because it was so like, it was such a incendiary movie. It changed filmmaking. It changed everything. Uh-huh. So that was my, like, I do remember that moment. And I've seen it, I think, 100 times. I mean, everyone's seen it a million times. It's just always on. It's always talked about. It's like a cultural touchstone. Everyone's been trying to rip it off ever since.
Right. There's like 50 Pulp Fiction posters in any given college dorm building.
Yeah. And one of the issues with like a movie like that, let's say you love it. If you love like a movie and it changes everything, the problem though is then every movie for the next 20 years is a knockoff of that movie and it sucks. So that's like the real problem with changing the game is just like no one else can do it, but they're gonna do it. And so that's annoying.
Was that your first like rated R movie?
I don't think so. I like kind of grew up fast.
Well, okay.
Yeah, Charlotte's Web. I was like 6. Just kind of I've seen everything. I only watch R. I've only seen R's.
It's wild that you probably saw The Lion King and Pulp Fiction the same
Honestly,
year.
Honestly, yeah.
The
I think I
year.
Saw, what was the Space Jam around that time? Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, Pulp Fiction, it's brutal. Like, in rewatching it last night just for this podcast, I was like, oh, this is insane. This should be X, I think. Like, this is like a crazy thing. How could you explain this to anyone?
Well, the thing is, I feel like if a movie is rated like NC-17 or whatever... Is that what you mean by, like, an X rating?
Yeah, I'm so old, I call it X.
It still sounds cooler.
Well, there's, like...
Bring back X.
I feel like a lot of X-rated movies are rated that way because there's some sort of... There's, like, graphic sex, but usually not, like, hetero sex.
Sure.
A lot of...
Well, and just the idea that sex is, like, more upsetting than violence is just, like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
On this viewing, because I haven't seen this movie in a couple of years, there were entire... large, disturbing sections of this movie that I had totally forgotten about. Mm-hmm. I had completely forgotten about the extended rape plot.
Yeah, with Marcellus Wallace.
Completely forgotten about it.
Yeah.
That was jarring. I was fully awake.
Speaking of this movie getting ripped off, may I tell you about a student film that I made that basically ripped off of Pulp Fiction?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
It's a... roughly 7-minute short called Exchange. It centers around a $20 bill that has like an X marker, like someone wrote an X with a marker on the $20 bill. And it follows us among all these different characters who each have a certain vice. Like the one guy is like a drug addict. They like roll it up and they like use the $20 bill to snort cocaine. Another one is like a gambling person or like a cheater. I forget.
Is it all the same $20 bill?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it connects all these characters and things like happen out of chronological order. And I was just like, I'm so fucking brilliant, you guys, for making this stupid movie. Yeah, I have not seen it in many years. I would imagine it does not hold up.
Is it somewhere?
Is it on Blu-ray?
Can we find it? Can we find
The director's cut is on available for purchase on Amazon. No, I have not put it on YouTube or anything like that. I'm far too embarrassed for that.
God, there's so much embarrassing stuff just like buried out there. I have an ebook somewhere out there.
It sucks that like the only way to do it now is to just be so horrible in public and then you maybe get a chance 10 years later to do something good. Like that's the only way to do anything is to be horrible, but for some reason need the validation and not care too much about the shame in an effort to one day know what you're doing. But it's like horrible.
And all your horribleness is fully archived for the world to find. When you get good at something.
Right. Yeah, I think like, inspiring. I think also it's weird because I think a large part of, especially with filmmakers, there's this myth around a lot of like male filmmakers like Kubrick and stuff where it's like, they're perfect. That's not true. They just didn't have YouTube. So they weren't like uploading the shitty fucking student films they did. They were burning the negatives of the stuff that sucked and then only putting up the stuff that worked. You know what I mean? And now there's less of a myth. It's a lot of just like, yeah, just be shitty and figure it out eventually. Like that's what it is.
Wouldn't it be amazing if we had the option in like a filmography thing for something to be parentheses lost? Because that's like, yeah, that's like the first couple of years of so many famous directors. They're like, oh, we don't know.
Yeah.
It's gone. It's like, oh, it probably was just bad and someone disposed of it.
Mm-hmm.
If only that were an option.
Well, I'd definitely take down all my old stand-up videos of like really dumb shit I've said and
fully private.
They're nowhere to be found. Anyway, so
let's talk about Pulp Fiction.
Let's do it. Jamie, you've seen this movie once before. What's your history with it?
I've seen this movie. I think this was maybe my third time seeing it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I'm late to every movie. I've seen Doubt 500 times and every other movie once. I saw this movie in, I want to say maybe late high school with some friends, and everyone thought it was so fucking cool. And then I saw it again in college, same deal. And I saw it last night. And this is like, I like this movie. I don't have any particular attachment to it, but I like it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw it for the first time, I think, in high school as well. I remember going to the video store and being like, there are certain movies that I just need to see because I was like, I'm going to be a film major. I have to have seen these movies.
I know,
so I
like
went and I rented Fargo, Pulp Fiction, and The Princess Bride, three movies that I had never seen before. And I watched them all. I was like, wow.
That's a good mix.
Yeah, I was like, they were right. These movies are pretty good.
Who's they?
You know, they.
It was a listicle on theguardian.com. There was one point where, yeah, I would just like look up lists that people I had heard of had like made of things that they liked. I'm like, well, I'll just go look at that and then spiral out from there, which is like a misguided but sort of effective way when you're very young to go
I think
about
it's a
it.
Great way to do it.
Yeah.
I think it's like the only, I feel like everything I read or watch is just interviews with people who make stuff. They're like, also do that.
Right,
yeah. Like
right.
That's kind of it. Like, I don't really know how else to do it. Cause I don't trust, I think sometimes when you take opinions from good friends, there's a real danger there because a lot of people that are smart have terrible taste. Like, they're just not smart about entertainment. Mm-hmm. And you're like, once you know what they like I'm having a personal problem with people liking Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh, I've seen how much trouble you've been.
And it's so horrible, and I'm losing friendships. Like, and it's like, I don't want to know what friends like. I just want to know what the cool people like. And then then at least I won't be hurt when we disagree, you know?
Sure.
Feel free to go on your Three Billboard tirade at any
point. We can talk about that at some point, for sure.
At any point. I mean, my whole formative years were writing down anything that was mentioned in this series of unfortunate events books and then just going to locate them. Mm-hmm. But it was actually very helpful, and I like found out a lot of stuff that I like and know about now because of those little books.
All right.
That's good.
How cute.
I like those better than Pulp Fiction.
Okay, sure.
I'm going to go home.
How about I do a recap of Pulp Fiction.
Caitlin's recap.
So this is a movie in which the events do not happen in chronological order.
I'm sorry,
things are
what?
All like, this thing happens and then this thing happens, but then we flash. It's a whole thing. So bear in mind. So we start out on a couple who are in a dire and die. I cannot fucking talk to
They're
it.
In a diehard.
Meryl Streep is on Diner Street.
So the movie Diner. So they're in a diner and they announce, this is a robbery. Well, then we cut to John Travolta.
Amazing reenactment. Thank you so much.
Hey, guys.
This is actually a robbery.
I know you thought we were just
like dancing a polka, but the guns are real.
Actually, guys.
We want your money.
We're still going to pay for the meal, but...
Okay, so then we cut to John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, and they're talking about royales with cheese.
They're having
a conversation.
Chatty Cathy's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're like, wow, 6 minutes of dialogue equals revolutionary. Pretty amazing stuff.
So they go to these people's apartment on behalf of their boss, Marcellus Wallace, who is some sort of organized crime mobster type of dude.
Bad element.
Right. Yeah. And they're there to collect a briefcase that's full of light bulbs? We don't know. It's a MacGuffin. And they are trying to get the briefcase from these people who have totally fucked over Marcellus Wallace. And then John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, whose characters' names are Vincent Vega and Jules Winfield?
Winstreet.
They shoot them up. And then we meet Butch, played by Bruce Willis. He's a boxer. We meet Marcellus Wallace, and he's like, he basically gives him money to fix a fight. And then this is a fun scene because Vincent Vega and Jules Winfield / Winstreet show up in different clothes than we saw them in before. And we're like, what is this all about?
Like, wait, is this perhaps nonlinear?
Oh, my God.
Hold the phone.
Mm-hmm. Then Vince Vega goes and buys heroin from Eric Stoltz. Then he takes Mia Wallace.
We've all been there.
We've all been in dire straits from Eric Stoltz.
That part was just a documentary.
It's just bad writing. You can't just...
Because he got let go of Back to the Future. He was the original dude, so he needed to
peddle heroin. He was supposed to be Marty McFly, and they shot most of the movie with him, and then he got recast because...
What did he do?
He was too serious.
He was, oh.
Yeah, and you just shouldn't do that.
He succeeded too hard. People were threatened.
So then Vincent Vega takes out Mia Wallace, played by Uma Thurman, which is Marcellus Wallace's wife.
Takes out for fun.
For fun, not kills. Not in a murder way.
Right.
They go out dancing. They go out to dinner. It's a great time. They go back to her house. She finds the heroin that he had bought in his pocket. She snorts it thinking it is cocaine. Then she ODs and he has to go deal with that. They go back to Eric Stoltz's house and she gets an adrenaline shot. Then we cut to young Butch receiving his
Young Butch, his baby. Dad's... That's my SoundCloud rapper name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Butch.
He receives his dad's watch from Christopher Walken. He's like, your dad hid this up his asshole for 5 years and now I'm giving it to you.
Which is a great plot point. The whole time we were watching Chris Walken in this movie... Which you first of all made fun of me for calling him Chris Walken.
Yeah.
Chrissy.
He actually goes by Christy. And
is he Chris walking down the street?
Christy.
The Merrill Street.
Okay. I was like, wait, where are we connecting it? I was just thinking about his scene in Geely the whole time I was watching his scene.
God.
How many movies is Christopher Walken in for exactly one scene?
Two. Geely and Pulp Fiction.
He's actually the only two movies
he's ever been in. He's never been in any other movies. Try to think of another one.
When you tell me things, I believe it. It's not good. It's bad. Go back and rewatch Christopher Walken's scene in Geely.
Please don't.
He doesn't know.
Never watched Geely.
He has no idea he's in the movie. He thinks he's just visiting. They're just like, hey, do you want to just talk to Ben Affleck for like... 4 minutes, and he does. He's holding a cup from Crafty. He's holding like a cup with a pattern on it, and he's just in a suit, and it's like he thinks he's visiting. He doesn't know he's never heard of that movie before.
No one has.
What happened to Natalie Wood, Christopher Walken? Tell us.
I know, right?
He knows.
He definitely knows.
He for sure knows.
Well, anyway.
What's happening in the movie?
So then we flash forward to Adult Butch, which is my rapper name. And
we tour together. Yeah.
Old Butch is a pretty good name.
Old Butch closes out the
Old
show.
Butch? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have an uncle. Oh, wait, I've talked about... Every time I talk about my Uncle Butch on the show, you edit it out. I
because he's a criminal.
He's a con artist.
Yeah.
Shout out to my con artist uncle, Uncle Butch.
Okay, so then in the next scene, we flash forward to Adult Butch, And it's right after his boxing match, and he has not fixed the match like he promised he would. He instead kills his opponent, and he's fine with it. And he runs away, and he gets in this cab where this woman's like, tell me what it's like to kill a man.
To kill a man.
Esmeralda, right?
Yeah.
That's her name? Yeah.
Feminist icon Esmeralda, because all she cares about is what it's like to kill men.
Yeah.
I am on board.
And it's like, yeah, go for it. Find out. Just turn back and snap Bruce's neck.
Right.
Figure it out.
So then Butch goes to his girlfriend, Fabienne, and they're ready to run away. But she's like, fuck, I forgot your watch. And he's like, you stupid bitch. How could you forget my father's watch?
He flips out.
He flips a table.
He's like, you forgot the ass watch. And he's mad.
So he goes back to his apartment, but Vincent Vega is there ready to kill him. And he finds his gun and he shoots Vincent. And Vincent is dead now.
And we're like, wait a second. Is this linear? Are we going to see this guy again or what?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Then Butch runs into Marcellus Wallace, who he had just fucked over for not fixing the fight. And then they have this like whole fight where he runs Marcellus over with a car. They end up in a pawn shop.
Kathy Griffin did you see the Kathy Griffin cameo?
No.
I'm sorry, but when Marcellus Wallace wakes up and all the like people are there with him, the person who talks to him is Kathy Griffin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the red-haired, curly-haired lady.
I can help you.
She's like, it was that
heart.
Guy. He was crazy. It was over there. Yeah. I'll testify for you.
Griffin.
That's Kathy Griffin.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
It's fun.
I'm altered. That's exciting.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that's a very important thing.
I got to find that screenshot. Post-haste.
So they end up in a pawn shop, Butch and Marcellus, and they're like scuffling. And the pawn shop owner's like, hang on a minute. Let me take you down to this sex dungeon.
Sorry, we were just looking at a screen cap of Kathy.
That's quite all right. I was just talking about a sex dungeon.
She looks great.
So this cop shows up. He gets a gimp out of a cage. And they're like, okay, time for me to rape you. And then they...
That's my new rage.
When you said that, I saw it as time, then the number four, me, the number two, rape you. That's how I saw it in my head.
That was a fully green text.
It's a weird synesthesia.
That's the classic green text. God,
not to make light of rape. Okay, so Butch and Marcellus get all tied up. Marcellus gets raped by this horrible rapist cop. And then Butch is like, actually, I'm going to fight my way out of this. So he undoes his bondage. He
has a sword, does he not?
Yeah, he goes up because he's about to... He punches the gimp. He runs away and he's like, wait a minute. I can't just let Marcellus suffer this horrible fate. So he gets a sword from the pawn shop, goes back downstairs, slices people up.
Fights for his boy.
The cop gets his dick shot off. In my favorite scene in the movie. And then Marcellus and Butch are like, we're cool. Then we cut to Vincent and Jules at the apartment that we saw them at before. Whoa, this
Hold
isn't.
The phone. Hold the phone.
In chronological.
Is this story told in order
Whoa,
or what?
It sure isn't.
This isn't what I'm used to.
So, right? another person who we had not seen before comes out. Shoots at them, but misses. And then Jules has this like religious experience where he's like, wow, what a miracle. I'm going to leave this life of organized crime and just like be a nice boy. And then they take this guy, Marvin, with them.
I'm going to leave this life of organized crime and be a nice boy. My name is Jules.
Jules Winfield. So they take this guy, Marvin, with him. They're in the car.
What if we made every person who'd committed a crime say in a court of law, I'm going to be a nice boy now? I know I messed up, but I'm going to be a nice boy now.
Mm-hmm. And or then girl. Just or
turn him loose.
Non-binary person, you know?
Right. Criminals come in all shapes.
No, everyone has to say nice boy.
Okay, so they take this guy Marvin, who is at the apartment with them, and because I guess they're all pals, and then Vincent accidentally blows his head off with his gun. So then they have to go to this guy Jimmy's house, played by our good friend Quentin Tarantino.
Feminist icon Quentin Tarantino.
And then they call this guy Winston Wolfe, Harvey Keitel, and they're like, help us clean this up. And they're like covered in blood from cleaning out all the crap out of the car. Then they have to put on these different clothes. Whoa, those are the clothes we saw them in a scene earlier in the movie. What? And then Jules and Vincent go to a diner for breakfast, the same one that we saw the couple in at the very beginning of the movie.
Have we come full circle or something?
We have. Stop. And then they're in the middle of the robbery. And then basically Jules is like, don't take this briefcase. It does not belong to you. It's for my boss. He loves light bulbs. And then he's just like, don't be a nice boy. Basically, he's like, be a nice boy. Don't be a robber. Be a nice boy. Bye. And that's the end of the movie.
Be a nice boy. Bye. Cut to credits.
Yeah. So that is the story.
Good recap.
I think you did a great job.
Good recap.
Thank you.
We did it. You did it.
We all did it.
It was a group effort.
Mm-hmm. Now.
Now that we have that out of the way, what shall we discuss?
Well, we shall discuss the representation and portrayal of women.
Well, given that I apparently forgot large swaths of this movie, there are a lot of female characters in this movie.
There are.
There's a lot to talk about.
None of them are, apart from Mia Wallace, I would argue, none of them are main characters. I would say most of them are more secondary or even tertiary.
Agreed.
So hardly any of them have any sort of influence in the story. In fact, I was thinking about like how crucial women are to the story and what the female characters do to contribute to the story and influence like the direction that the story takes. Because in a movie like this, where there's like an ensemble cast, it's really sort of hard to discern who is the protagonist because there's like these little vignettes and they're all connected. I would argue no one main character.
I would agree.
Okay, so I think then it is safe to assume that any character in the movie could do something that would significantly impact the story. However, of the female characters we see, none of them really do it in a way that moves the story forward, or if they do, it's a mistake they've made that the men have to correct. For example, so we've got Mia Wallace accidentally snorting the heroin, thinking it's cocaine, and Vincent has to take her to his drug dealer to get the shot of adrenaline so she doesn't OD and die.
Right.
In other words, she makes a mistake that a man has to fix.
So that actually, watching it this time through, was kind of, because I knew the basic plot points, and I knew that she did that eventually, but the scenes leading up to that, she is so in control and she's so active. And then kind of at that moment when she makes this mistake, she is like kind of damseled right away. And all the action she's taken is sort of totally backpedaled on. And she, I mean, yeah, women are mostly reacting in this story. They're not pushing action.
What's interesting about that, because I've never watched it from this perspective, because it's a movie based in just entertainment. Like, it's clear Quentin Tarantino doesn't give a shit about issues, right? He's just like, he's trying to entertain you. And that's part of the problem with some of his movies, or maybe all of them. But
he's an homage
What was
boy.
Interesting about the Mia Wallace thing, I was thinking about it, and I was like, oh, well, she's introduced as Marcellus's wife. So that's like how she's introduced as a wife, right? But she is such a bold, strong character. Her haircut is just cool as shit. She's very like, you know, she's leading the conversation. She like tells him to, as you were saying, Jamie, like she tells him like, you think of something to say. You know, she's very active.
And then she's like, I want to dance. Let's dance.
Yeah, and also when Vincent comes into her place, she's like, do this, do that. You know what I mean? She's bossing him around.
Right. She's picked the restaurant. She's made the reservation. Yeah. Like
she orders a $5 shake. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I will say the thing about the heroin is it is a man fixing the mistake, but also she takes his drugs. She like takes what's not hers, is active. I mean, I don't know what that means necessarily, but she does sort of like move it forward with like, it wasn't necessarily a bad choice. It was just like a genuine mistake. Because the powder is white, right?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know the intricacies of the Bechdel test, so I will learn a lot as we speak.
Mm.
But I guess it is him cleaning up that mess. But it felt, that felt the most okay with a female character. Because she, at the end, still, I feel like, she still had the ability to, like, fuck Vincent over if she told Marcellus. But then she was like, but then she would die, basically, if she told him.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which he didn't totally believe. There's, like, that exchange they have after she is revived, and, you know, she's like, well, I'm not going to tell him because I'd be fucked over too. And he's like, well, you wouldn't be as fucked over as I would. But she very well may be, because at this point we haven't met Marcellus. We don't know what kind of person he is.
What I was curious about there was, what do you think would have happened to her? That she did the drugs? Like, that was the problem, that she's a drug addict and he wouldn't like that?
I mean, I got the impression that he probably knew that she was using drugs. I mean, they're into all sorts of, you know, like illicit behaviors.
Right.
But
for me, my immediate instinct, and it's not really followed up on, but I thought it was because she did it with a man. And like there was like some sort of
Marcellus
intimacy.
Paid Vincent to take her out and show her a good time, basically.
And then he like quote unquote fucked up, even right. though it was kind of out of both of their control.
Right. So it was sort of like we can presume that like that Marcellus was like, take care of her, make sure she's safe while I'm gone because she needs looked after because you're a man and she's a woman and she needs protection. But
right. Which is why he's doing that in the first place.
Right. But, well, yeah, so the way Mia Wallace is introduced, like you said, Jules and Vincent are talking about her, and they have that whole conversation about this guy being thrown out of a window because mm-hmm. he gave her a foot massage. So, like, we hear about this character. I think the point of the conversation is to maybe show how much of a force to be reckoned with Marcellus Wallace is.
I think definitely more, like, because she's the possession mm-hmm. that no one right. can fuck with.
Which right. basically just objectifies her.
Well, but definitely then, she's introduced as the wife.
Right, yeah.
Right.
But I think to be the wife of this man, Marcellus, I mean, Marcellus is a very intense character. He's like, mm-hmm. you know, immediately legendary. Because also, like, the way he's introduced, it's not even on him. You don't even see him. The way he's introduced, you hear right. his voice, you're just looking at Bruce
the
Willis.
The back of his head.
And in the back of his head, it's like the mark of the beast or something like that? Is that what the Band-Aid is?
Oh,
I always thought that's what it was because it's connected to like the thing that was in the suitcase, which I feel like is a human soul or something. And like, but I think the Band-Aid is supposed to be, that's where you, like the devil enters or some bullshit like that. Oh. That's like there's some reason why there's a Band-Aid
okay.
there.
I didn't know anything about that sort of mythology.
But he's like, you know, this really intense character. So you're like, yeah. And like, if you're like a drug underlord or overlord? Why would
both sound sinister?
Because both are correct. Because it's like the underworld, but you're an overlord.
The overlord of the underworld.
Yeah. What is the over under on the? But yeah, it's interesting because like that woman is never gonna be. If it's a male like drug peddler, it's probably not gonna be like he's gonna be stronger than the female character most of the time, right? Like so she's like a kept woman to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I mean I think that's like an interesting writing choice that's made in this movie. And again, it's hard to tell, especially with like early Quentin Tarantino, how intentionally it's actually done. But it's like we do first hear about Mia Wallace as basically the property of Marcellus that you do not fuck with. Mm-hmm. But then we meet her and we do learn more about her background. We learn that she was an actress. We learn there's more depth to her mm-hmm. and she's very open and she takes control of the situation. And that was kind of like a fun or interesting inversion of getting to know a character that mm-hmm. is introduced to us as property.
Right.
But then the scene I want to talk about that really bugged me when we were watching it was when she does overdose and then John Travolta brings her to Eric Stoltz's house where there are, I don't know what their names are, but they have names.
Oh, there's two women Jody and Trudy.
That scene bugged me because I was like, in any realistic world, the two women in that scene would have resolved that problem and way faster than John Travolta and Eric Stoltz would have. And watching them sidelined in that scene,
that was frustrating.
Frustrated me because they were intentionally sidelined for whatever reason. But like they are at least Eric Stoltz's, I think, girlfriend in that scene.
No, it's his wife.
His wife. Okay,
that's
yes,
an Arquette, right?
Yes, Rosanna,
yes, Rosanna Arquette. Yeah. She is in the background of the entire scene watching it happen very passively. And I don't know, like that.
Well, she's sort of, she's like kind of screaming at Eric Stoltz's character. She's sort of depicted as a shrew, be like, why did you bring her here? Like right. very just like nagging and screaming and combative and just difficult to deal with. And then her friend Trudy is like for sure very passive to the point where she's literally just sitting
smoking
on the couch. Yeah, like
she's like smoking a bong through the entire scene.
I did think that like watching it this time, like because that wasn't the first time Rosanna Arquette's in the movie. She's in it the first time he goes there to buy the heroin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yeah. she's the wife, and then for no real reason, Eric Stoltz is just kind of a piece of shit to her. You know what I mean? Like, he's just kind of like, fuck you. Mm-hmm. There was a really cool moment, though, in the scene you were just talking about when they stab Mia Wallace's heart with adrenaline, where it made me laugh so hard this time where just before, like, John Travolta's holding up the adrenaline, Eric Stoltz is counting to three, and there's a shot of Rosanna Arquette's face where she's like, almost like sexually interested in the moment. You know what I mean? She's like, And that was cool. Because I was like, that's an active choice for her to just be like a fucking crazy pervert, kind of.
Very into,
and I,
yeah.
And I did enjoy that part.
Okay.
Where I was like, okay, at least she's like a sicko. You know what I mean?
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah.
I'd have
it's really funny. It made me, I was watching with a female friend and we both laughed really hard about it. Mm. It was just like kind of random, but funny. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Just like, I'm going to see some shit right now.
Also in Eric Stoltz and Rosanna Arquette's house, there's a board game called Chauvinist Pigs.
Really?
In the back of a shop.
There were a lot of board games there.
There's
like Life and it's funny.
Yeah, there when he's looking for the black medical book that he's screaming about for a good portion of that scene, there he walks past this board game called Chauvinist Pigs.
Didn't notice that either.
Again, it's like probably not an intentional choice, but I enjoyed it.
Sure. So I want to go back to Mia Wallace. So she's initially framed as like this person who's talked about but not seen as like, oh, the property of this bad guy who's scary and you don't want to fuck with her or touch her feet because he'll throw you out of a window sort of thing. And then we do meet her. And like you said, she's kind of, she's got a lot of autonomy. She's kind of bossing him around like, go make yourself a drink, do this, do that, take me out, I want to dance, making choices. And we also see her, she has a personality unlike so many female characters we encounter in so many movies,
right,
where we can get a sense of who she is as a person.
I would argue the most memorable character from that movie. Like, I think in pop culture, she's on the poster. And I think she's the one that I think about, like, her haircut and her eye. Like, just remember that image.
I was going to say, Sam Jackson, I think they're kind of tied for first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is great. And when you sort of pit them against each other in terms of screen time, it's all the more impressive because she's not in the movie a ton.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly the top half that she's in.
The only other time she's in the movie is when she's like in a bathing suit just catering to her husband by the pool. You remember that?
Right.
I wasn't sure if that was her.
Yeah,
or
you
not.
Almost don't realize it's her.
Right.
But she's just like the wife there.
I just thought maybe that was another woman that like a side
Thurman.
I think he loves his wife. I think he loves his wife.
Okay.
I think got
he
that
does.
Feeling. Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think he does.
Yeah.
I don't know. He just doesn't know how to show it.
But
he just doesn't know. He's got to learn.
Well, he's an assault victim.
Right.
That's true.
Oh, poor Marcellus. But the other thing I want to say about that scene in the restaurant is that Mia dispels the rumor that a guy was thrown out of a window because he touched her feet. She's like, do you really believe that? Like, that's absurd. And whether or not if it happened that way, because she could easily be lying and being like that. Well, that's crazy, because it is crazy. But she at least stands up for herself.
I also thought one of the cool lines about that, because that scene was really interesting, where she goes, the only time he ever touched me was when he shook my hand at my wedding. Which I thought was a very, like, that was cool. That was like a very intentional choice, because like, it could have been a hug.
Yeah.
But it was shaking my
hand.
That
was a power move. Yeah, that was great. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, that whole conversation, she's completely in, like, John Travolta is, like, in her hands entirely. Mm-hmm. Like, she steers that conversation entirely. And also, like, it sounds like she doesn't even know exactly what happened. The comment she makes about when men talk about things, it's like a sewing circle. That was, like, a really fun line in that particular exchange where she's, you know, directly taking a rude comment usually directed at women and saying it to John Travolta. Great. Loved it.
Yeah. What she says is, when you little scamps get together, you're worse than a sewing circle.
Love the use of the word scamps.
Yeah.
Anytime scamps can be thrown in, I'm there. Good.
So then following that scene in the restaurant, they go back to her house. She invites Vincent Vega in, and he is like, I got to go to the bathroom and talk myself out of trying to fuck her, because that's clearly what he wants to do.
That's clearly what I think he thinks she wants to do.
Oh, interesting.
That's how I read that was, because there's that moment where, like, they're at the door. She's in control. It's her night. You know what I mean? And, like, he, I think, clearly wants to sleep with her. She's portrayed as this, like, sexual, you know, she's, like, impressive.
She's desirable.
And, like, yeah, and it's just, like, she's cool and, like, she's in charge. But I thought, you know, there's that moment where they're in the door and they look in each other's eyes and he's like, is that what you call an uncomfortable silence? And she's like, I don't know what that was. You know, I don't know what you'd call that. So I feel like she's like, you're going to stick around. We're going to do this. So I think she wants I don't think she's going to fuck him, But I did feel like she wants to be flirted with. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, she wants that attention, whatever she's not getting from Marcellus. Because why the fuck isn't he taking her out?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He's and out of town.
I still felt like, I think he felt like, I want to do this, but I obviously shouldn't. Mm-hmm. But I did feel like, I still felt like she was guiding that.
Possibly. I more interpreted as, like, they were hanging out. She's all high on coke. They're drinking. And he has to be like, well, I have an opportunity, possibly, but I'm not going to act on it because that would be a betrayal of trust to my boss, Marcellus. So he's, like, talking to himself in the mirror for who knows how long. Long enough for
really
her
funny.
To OD
yeah,
on
like
heroin.
30 minutes.
But yeah, he's like, but he's like, you're just going to go home and jerk off and just go to bed. And then he comes out and she has already mm-hmm. snorted the heroin. And then he has to like jump to action to go save her.
I interpreted that scene as she was manipulating him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit for attention, but also just because she has known the whole night that he'll basically do whatever she tells him to do.
Right.
Because throughout the night, she, you know, wants to compete in this dance competition. He's like, okay, we'll do it. She's like, think of something to say. He's like, okay, I'll do it. So she's, I think, at the beginning of that scene, still fully in control. And then, to me, that scene where John Travolta's talking to himself for 45 minutes is like him trying to convince himself that he's the one in control and he's the one who's going to make the choice. Like, am I going to fuck her? I have to decide what I'm going to do. When it's sort of made clear that entire sequence that he's not the person who's in control of.
Yeah, he's kind of like a dork there.
Yeah.
Like in that scene,
like
he's kind of made to be a dork where she's just like, that's why I thought it's interesting because he does have to save her, but he's not very good at it. Like he kind of like he right. barely does it. But I just thought it was such an active choice for her to steal his drugs.
Right.
She's like, this is mine.
And that leans into like the whole manipulative thing, too, of like, oh, well, while you're like trying to talk yourself out of thinking that you could fuck me if you wanted to, which who knows, she takes his stuff. Yeah. And then the power dynamic shifts. And that's I don't know. It's interesting in a story perspective.
Right. I mean, I think the main takeaway is that it's impressive that we see a female character with a personality who's sort of taken control of the situation that they're in that night where, you know, they're kind of out on the town, but she's sort of the alpha of that whole interaction.
For sure,
it's just something we so rarely see that it was kind of refreshing.
Yeah. And she just is so good. Like, she's just such a good actor. It was just awesome. I mean, she's, you can't take your eyes off. What I also liked about her character was like, it wasn't just cool. Like, what I was thinking about this time was, like, she's a failed actor. Like, she's kind of has, like, a weird personality. You know what I mean? Like, she's not, she's cool, and she, like, has her thing, but she's kind of not, like, she's a failure. And she's kind of, like, some of the things she said, like, she reacts a little more excitedly than most cool characters would. Like, she's just kind of, she's like a drug addict failed actor. And but she was still in control. And I thought that was a really cool way to portray someone. Like, I was kind of impressed by how not, like, she is cool, but she's like, I remember when she was responding about, like, I can't promise you that. If a more stereotypical man were writing her, I'd be like, I can't promise you that. You know what I mean? Da, da, da. But she's like, I can't promise you that. Like, it was more, like, quirkier, I thought, which I thought was cool.
Well, that might just be her. I don't know if that's more the writing or more just sort of her choices as an actor. Hard to say.
Man, it's great, especially now watching this movie and being like, wow, now Uma Thurman's just threatening to shoot Harvey Weinstein all the time on Instagram. It's great. I love it. This whole time, I was like, she threatened to shoot Harvey Weinstein. That's so cool.
It is
love
really
it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, we're just so used to seeing very flat, one-dimensional female characters that we're like, it's pretty cool to be like, oh, she's got more than one dimension. And the TV show that she was in the pilot for sounds pretty fucking cool, like a show that I would want to watch. Fox Force 5, it's about five cool women being bad. I mean,
Force
it probably
5.
Wouldn't be great, but I want to see Tarantino make that movie.
Oh,
next.
That'd be kind of cool if he
I
went
see
back
him.
And made Fox Force 5.
Yeah. And she has a sense of humor at the end of it, where after she's OD'd and nearly died, she's like, hey, let's maybe just forget about this. Want to hear that joke that I refused to tell you before? And he's like, sure. And then she tells a dumb ketchup joke. And we all laughed.
Yeah,
but
we're tee-heeing. It's great.
And she's not the only female character in this movie who we see some semblance of personality from, because I would say that Fabian has a pretty... We only see a little sliver of her in this movie. She's only in two scenes, but...
But those scenes are so good. It's in a more macro sense, it sucks that her presence doesn't have more bearing on the plot. And I would say that for almost every female character in this movie, with the exception of Mia, where it's like their actual effect on the plot, like we're talking about, is not huge, but her presence in the movie is so great.
Well, so like Mia Wallace, where if you are oversimplifying things, her main contribution to the actual, maybe not the characterization of the story, but the events of the story, is that she takes the drugs by accident, almost ODs, and it's a problem that a male character has to fix. Similar thing happens right. with Fabian Street. Fabian Street. She forgets Bruce Willis's like heirloom watch.
The butt loom.
And has to, he has to go back and get it. And it almost gets him killed. It gets him in this like crazy, almost he gets raped situation.
Yeah, things escalate pretty fast.
He had to kill two people to get out of it.
Yeah.
So because of her mistake that he has to fix, right. That's her main contribution, again, to the events of the story, not to the characterization of the movie, because she does have an interesting character who has a personality. Again, something that we're not used to seeing in movies, for a female character to have a personality. But I just couldn't help but notice, of the female characters who do things that influence the direction the story takes in a significant way, both of them can be boiled down to a female character making a mistake and a man having to fix it.
I would also argue that the Amanda Plummer, who I believe it's Amanda Plummer, the one who is Tim Roth's wife, she kind of is bad at her thing too. Like, I think she's not great at being a robber. You know what I mean? She kind of needs his guidance
in the last
very
scene,
much.
Especially.
Yeah. So I was like, almost she doesn't necessarily fuck up, but she's. She needs his, like in a similar way, mm-hmm. I would say, is like needs right. the male counterpart's guidance to kind of, is relying on him to fix situations.
Right, because she seemed kind of like a loose cannon where she might shoot someone.
So such a good actor. Like, uh-huh. I was like, oh, you are so funny and so good. But yeah, I think, yeah, she's a little clearly mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's true. I struggled with the last scene, with her in the last scene in particular.
I gotta go pee.
Where, yeah, I was like, oh man, of course, you know, of the two, she's the one to fuck up or like show some sort of weakness. And I do feel like that choice had to be intentional to some extent, even if it was just like instinct on a male writer's part to have the female character fuck up. But then there's like all these themes, especially with Bruce Willis's character in this movie, where the whole ass watch thing is all about this, like, it's this whole masculinity plot where he's trying to get his father's war heirloom. Mm-hmm. He, you know, doesn't have a war to fight. And that's the whole, you know, where it's Gen X, it's the 90s, very whatever.
He's fighting wars in the boxing ring.
He's fighting his own battle, right? but that like masculine heirloom is so important to him that he will cut down fucking whoever to get his dad's
right. mm-hmm.
ass watch instead of, oh, I don't know, letting it go. Like, mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, all the characters in this movie are very flawed to the point where it was frustrating to see Amanda Plummer's character fuck up at the end. But I feel like I felt that because we hadn't seen enough women on screen at all for there to be a, like, we see male characters fuck up constantly in this mm-hmm. movie. That's like not an issue, but there's just like not enough female characters with bearing on the plot that we see fuck up so that it feels equal.
Right.
The really interesting thing I thought about Fabienne was watching it this time. There's actually a bunch of things I thought that were very interesting about that relationship. One was when they're hooking up, she's like, will you go down to me? And he's like, will you kiss it? And she goes, basically, if you eat me out first. Yeah. So it was a real great talk about consent.
It was also tight.
Like, she's like, you make me come first, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool because he's like, he's a boxer. You know what I mean? Like, right. He's like a meathead. So I thought that was cool. But I also thought that...
Although it annoyed me that, like, she was like, give me oral pleasure. And he's like, will you kiss it? Not agreeing to what she asked, but immediately being like, well, only if you suck my dick also. And she has to be like, but you first, because I asked you first. But, like, I don't know. It annoyed me that
I enjoyed that exchange in general. I don't know.
I thought that was very much a relationship exchange.
Yeah,
I understand what you're saying. I mean, mm-hmm. like, I get it. But, like, I was like, at least she... Like, if that had been reversed... That would have been a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I thought this was at least a boxer going down on a tiny woman. I was like, okay, good. Like, good. Boxers are giving oral pleasure. This is a step forward. The other interesting thing I thought I was watching with a female friend, and so I asked her about it, and we were talking about this. Now, I'm very curious how you feel when he gets mad about the watch. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
yes, yeah.
So that was a really interesting scene, I thought. So he gets mad. He starts yelling. She goes in the corner of the room, right? Where, like, the wall's connected.
Because he flips a table, like, well,
I thought he throws a TV.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He throws
something
a TV,
happened.
But not at her. He throws a TV at a rage. He's a rageful boxer. Yeah. So he throws a TV. Yeah. But so that's, like, bad, obviously. But then what I thought was interesting, and this is what I asked my friend, he sits on that chair and he goes, you know what? It's my fault. I didn't accurately tell you. You did your best. I didn't tell you how important it was to me. Mm-hmm. And, right. Like, I'm sorry. I just got to go. Don't worry about it. So he has a rage flip out. He, like, it has some sort of aggression. You could call it violence if you want. I don't think it was directed at her necessarily, but maybe. And then he's like, I'm sorry. And then in the car,
he starts freaking out.
He's like,
out
oh,
again,
how
basically.
Could you not? You know it's important to me. But,
right.
But I thought it was interesting because their relationship was very, I thought, bizarrely charming, because it was sort of like almost stereotypical in the way but there was real love there. I thought it was the most love in the whole movie, mm-hmm. in a way.
Right.
And I thought, my friend was like, you know what? He apologized immediately. And it was kind of interesting where he was like really aggressive and but he clearly really loved her, and he did apologize immediately. And for someone who is such a probably like an alt-right weirdo, I thought
sure
it was
interesting. Right.
And so I thought it was just interesting for him to have him apologize immediately. And I thought that was like I don't know if it has to do with the Bechdel test, but it has something to do with like how a relationship should work. You know what I mean? You make this mistake, right. And then but I don't know. I was curious what you guys thought about it.
He has a snap reaction. I mean, I could have done without him, you know, throwing a TV.
For sure.
To the point where she's so scared for her safety that she cowers into
she
a
cries.
Corner
yeah.
and
well,
is crying.
Me, seeing her default to a corner,
right.
I'm like, this is
something.
Maybe not the first time this mm-hmm. has happened.
That's
if
true.
She has an instinct to retreat to a corner,
yeah.
where it's like, if that's the first time that's happening,
mm-hmm.
it just didn't seem like the first time
that,
so sure that it happened.
You're right.
But then when we see him dial back, I mean, it's hard because also, they're fictional. We don't know. No one truly knows.
He also does flirt with Esmeralda.
He does.
So he's a little bit of like a brute.
Well, all the men in this movie, I think that speaks to the like hyper-masculinity of all the men we see in this movie. Like there's no, I mean, except for maybe Eric Stoltz, like all the main characters
the
are like
non-sexual character in the movie.
They're just like dripping with like toxic hyper-masculinity. And sure, that's what the movie's about. They're you know, mm-hmm. all kind of, you know, these like bad criminal, you know, boxer, gun-slinging type of guys. But it's hard for me to watch movies like that nowadays, just to see so much hyper-masculinity and have it be celebrated and have people, I love this movie so much. And whereas of the women in the movie, if there was more of a balance, if some of those like scary characters were women, like if one of the hit people was a woman, in it just like struck more of a balance, it would be easier for me to watch. But now I'm just like so over this like celebration of hyper-masculinity that I'm like, ugh. That being said, this movie does a better job than a lot of them.
Yeah, especially because it kind of almost created it. Like, it created this run of, like, hyper-masculinity. It's like for it to, because what I said at the beginning of the podcast was, like, I truly feel like Quentin Tarantino doesn't give a fuck about big issues. Like, so when he's writing this movie, he's definitely not, like, his writing of Mia Wallace, he's not trying to be amenable to feminism. He's just trying to write a character you haven't seen before. He's like a film nerd who wants to see something you haven't seen before. I don't think he's writing it because he thinks men should do this and women should, you know what I mean? Like, he's just like, he like is like a movie. He's like, all he is like a movie. So he's just shitting out a movie that he wants to see because he wants to be cool. Like, it's called Pulp Fiction because it's based in all these sort of, like, it's like, there's a boxer, there's hitmen. It's like based in these like 50 cent novels, you know? And so I think he more cares about entertainment than anything. I don't think he gives a fuck. It's like, that's why he uses the N word. It's so awful, but he's like, I'm not racist. Like, he's not even really thinking about it. You know what I mean? He's trying to be cool. And he's a man, so he can't understand like any issues. And so I think it's hard because you have to judge the movie based on what it is. But he seems like a crazy sort of person who isn't even really interacting in society much. You know what I mean?
I mean, that's a bad excuse in 2017.
It's definitely a bad excuse.
Like,
no, I'm not.
To wake up.
It's not an excuse.
Yeah,
I just mean when I think about him,
sure.
I don't think he has a fuck. I don't think he gives a shit. You know what I mean?
I mean, especially when this movie's being made. This is like I feel like with, and we'll do more Tarantino movies in the future, his movies with time become more intentional. It's hard to trace intent with this movie, where it does just seem like, oh, this is cool. This is something like you were saying, something I would like to see. And you get a very interesting movie with a lot of stuff you haven't seen before in it as a result. But then the trade-off is, like, it kind of becomes hard to analyze, because it's like, a lot of times we see movies where women are either being sidelined or mistreated very intentionally, mm-hmm. because whatever the reason may be. And this is just, like, hard to tell what the intention for almost anything is, other than, this seems cool. Mm. I want to do this.
Yeah, I think it like, what's interesting about this movie too is it was like a very small budgeted movie. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. it's one of the most popular movies ever, but it became this phenomenon. So I think it became very influential, probably in a pretty negative way, to enhancing toxic masculinity. But it was more, he was just trying to, like, be cool. Like, I think he wasn't thinking, like, at least that's just what I get from him, where he's like, he's reversing tropes to some degree, just
it's
in what he's doing in scenes
sometimes.
Yeah, like, or like someone getting shot in the middle of a scene, or like, it's two hitmen just having, as you were saying, like a 6-minute conversation about, like, Amsterdam or feet or whatever. It's like, I clearly, when watching, is like, he's concerned with that shit and, like, being, having, like, these scenes, and then it became this, like, behemoth, and then all these men were like, I gotta make that, you know? Because I think I feel like the Fabian character is actually pretty bad. Like, I think that's, like, a pretty bad representation of a woman. Like, I think that's the worst by far. But I think...
How come?
Because she's a tiny person who seems helpless. She's sort of like a fantasy of a woman. Like, she's, like, French, has that haircut, kind of, like, and has, like, those big eyes, and, like, has these, like, white shirts. He kills it with the white shirts, by the way. Everyone wore amazing white shirts in that movie. Bruce and Fabian and...
Uma.
The white shirts were amazing. She doesn't really do anything. She talks about eating. She loves her boyfriend. That's what you know about her, mm-hmm. right? And then she fucks up and is kind of helpless. And then she's just kind of, and she cries a lot. So it's like kind of like, I'd say that's bad. But even then, I think what he's trying to do is just like have like an adorable foreign woman. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think he's really thinking, like, it seems like he never even thought about the fact that it's like a person. He's just writing these stupid,
That's what, I mean, we do see just a little sliver of this character, and she does have, I would argue, more personality than a lot of female characters have in movies, but because all the women in this movie are framed as, like, the romantic partner of one of the male characters who we know a little bit better, we see actually doing things, and they're just sort of like...
Besides Kathy Griffin.
And Kathy Griffin, the working women of the movie.
I mean, yeah, and the Esmeralda scene was a little bizarre. I mean, cool that you see the representation of a woman cab driver.
Taxi driving. The one last thing I wanted to say about Fabienne before we move on from that character is, while she does not have a lot of bearing on the plot, and her main significance in the plot is fucking up so that Bruce Willis can launch into all these other weird scenes and eventually hold a katana, which is, I think, what Quentin Tarantino wants the whole time, is like, how can I get from point A to Bruce Willis with a katana?
Yeah, that's the whole,
That's the most intent you'll find.
I do think that scene, by the way, but that scene was really funny when he's in the pawn shop and he goes from weapon to chainsaw, and then that is super funny.
There's like a hammer of
baseball. But the exchange between Bruce Willis, Butch, and Fabienne, and they're talking about bodies at the beginning of their exchange together, where she's like, there's that kind of weird, but I think kind of good line where she's talking about, like, I wish I had a pot belly, and he was like, why, that'd be fucking gross, or like, what, you know, whatever. They're back and forth, and it's very relationship talky. And then she says that line of like, oh, it's so weird that what feels good and what looks good to people is seldom the same, or something like that. And that for me was like, whoa, what an interesting, like, that character was used in some way that I got a positive takeaway from. Again, impossible to know if this is just words that Quentin Tarantino thought sounded nice next to each other, or if there was some intent next to it. But that whole, like, relationshipy scene between them, I thought pre him throwing a TV was very into their relationship. Post him throwing in a TV, it's like, now there's some stuff to address.
Well, there's also that part where she's like, I want a Potbelly. And he's like, if you had a Potbelly, I'd punch you in it. And we're like, ah, feminist icon Bruce Willis.
No. Not our feminist icon.
I did want to call attention to all the times in which a man in this movie calls a woman a bitch. Or
tell that bitch to chill.
Yeah, okay. Early on.
I've been known to say that every once in a while. To any gender.
When Jules is talking about Mia Wallace, he says something like, eating a bitch out and touching a bitch's feet, they're not even in the same ballpark. And then Eric Stoltz says, you're not bringing this fucked up bitch into my house. And then Vincent says about Eric Stoltz's wife, what a fucking bitch. And then Butch says to Fabian,
you know, sorry, you know what would make all of this even? If Bruce Willis's character's name was Bitch, then it would be totally fine.
Oh, so then you would have to be...
What's up, bitch?
Yeah, you would be young bitch. I would be adult
young bitch.
And then old bitch would come in eventually. And then this isn't bitch calling, but Butch calling her a bitch, but bitch. He says, do you know how fucking stupid you are? To Fabian. And then Jules at the end says, like, get that bitch under control or whatever.
Bitch be cool,
bitch
right?
Be cool. Yeah. So there's...
I love that line, though. It's front, man.
It's almost as if the
bitch
male
be
character...
Cool is a great line.
But it's almost as if the male characters in this movie are not feminist icons. Nor
what?
Are they... Okay, so speaking of language, one of the other reasons it's hard for me to watch this movie and enjoy it as much as I have in the past is that the N-word just gets thrown around casually...
Oh,
whew. All the time, often by white people, either to or in front of or just about people of color. And it is just very casual the way in which Quentin Tarantino is like, yeah, let's just drop 100
N-bombs. He's like, guys, I'll do it myself.
And also he has a black wife.
Yeah.
Which is so weird.
It's
doesn't get any
bizarre.
Doesn't get any lines.
We
you don't
see
even
her from
see
the
her
back.
Face.
You just know that she'd get mad.
Right. And divorce
right.
him because
right.
there's a dead body in her garage.
Like, what a
yeah.
bitch.
It's also just weird that Quentin Tarantino cast himself. Like, it's just like, oh, it's just,
yeah.
he's such a weird man. Like, what is he doing?
We were talking about this last night where it's like, at very least, Quentin Tarantino saw himself in this movie and was like, probably not again. Probably
yeah.
we're gonna hang it up here. Which I respect because most directors that are like, I want to be in it too. Like, they don't know when to say when all the time. And he was like, you know what? I maybe did a crummy job.
Yeah, the N-word is, like, it just is a little... Again, this is another thing where he's, like, trying to be cool, right? And what's interesting about him, I think, because he has written some roles for... A lot of, like, famous roles for black characters. There mm-hmm. are black actors who, like, defend it, you know? Like, Jamie Foxx has, or Samuel L. Jackson has. I'm sure Pam Grier did. You know what I mean? Like, things like that. But it is one of those things, like, I'm watching, I'm like, ooh. God, like it's two white characters talking to each other sometimes, like Stoltz mm-hmm. and Travolta. And it's like, why is that word there? Like, is yeah. this helping the movie? And it is a little,
yeah.
I did feel kind of viscerally upset. I was like, oh, what? Or when he says it to Samuel L. Jackson doesn't respond to that word. I also thought that was interesting. It's mm-hmm. like he's just saying, like, clearly they're friends and he doesn't seem to care about it, but it is a little like, what are we talking about here?
Well, that's...
What
I
are
mean,
we doing? Yeah.
It's because a white writer-director making the choices. A black writer and director probably would not have let that happen that way.
No, right. It's more just... I'm more just like, what do you think this is adding? Like,
right.
it's so weird.
Right.
Because,
it
because
the
it's...
90s.
It's just like a lack of
no, but I
again.
Saw Hateful Eight. I saw Hateful Eight in theaters, and that movie has the N-word a lot, way more than Pulp Fiction. And I saw it with, and there were like people of all colors in the movie theater, and I thought it was horrible. Like, I was like, this is really unnecessary, and I don't know why we're doing this. Like, it's not, like, it doesn't, you don't need that word to get across what's going, the movie isn't saying anything about race, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's
right,
just, like,
right.
what are we talking about here?
And I think it bugs me no matter where in Quentin Tarantino's oeuvre it shows up. It sucks and it's uncomfortable. And especially when in these movies where it's famously written by a white guy and you know exactly who it is, I feel like it makes it all the more uncomfortable to watch it be forced out of characters of any color's mouth.
Mm-hmm. It's just like...
But by
it's
the time,
just crazy. It's just sort of
right.
like to hear it, like, whoa. Like,
by the
that's
time we get to Hateful
me.
Eight, it's so intentional that it's like, why the fuck would you still
it's
be
doing just like a right. statement. It's, yeah. Right. It's like, no, I can hold on to my words. Like, it's just that freedom of speech bullshit, which is just like, what are we talking about,
exhausting.
Guys?
Exhausting.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to say about this movie is that there's a line that Harvey Keitel's character says as they're like all kind of parting ways. He says, just because you are a character doesn't mean that you have character. And I think that is a thesis statement for the way so many women are written in movies. Just because they are a character in the movie, technically, doesn't mean they
I didn't
have
think about that
character.
When hearing that line. I just thought it was like a kind of a dad joke. But,
I mean, sure,
but
that's,
right.
that's totally
no,
what it's
right.
intended
that's
to be.
A, that's very
but
funny.
But I absorbed it and I was like, hey, what a way to describe how women are portrayed in movies a lot of the time. So
can we really, really quick... And this is not like something to be like, hey, really quick, can we talk about the brutal rape scene in this movie? But it was very taken aback, but I must have blacked it out because I just straight up did not remember this happened in the movie. So there is a male-on-male rape scene in this movie, and there's a lot to unpack there. But what I thought was another like, okay, that was a choice that kind of felt true to the character of Marcellus is that Marcellus basically is like, this will never be spoken of again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's sort of where like Bruce Willis's story closes of like, okay, cool. We're never going to talk about the fact that I got raped again. And
we are going to talk about Kevin though.
We are.
Sorry.
Not till 2011. Like, it's not that we have to talk about Kevin, so we need to talk about Kevin.
Okay, I won't talk about what happened to you, but we do need to talk about Kev.
We need to talk about Kevin. He's troubled. He's got a bow and arrow in the backyard. What's going on with that kid? What a weird movie. Let's never
that movie
do that
sucked.
Movie on the show.
Movie
no. It was I've never seen it.
We don't. It turns out we didn't need to
so
talk
wait,
about Kevin.
So wait, can you? Sorry, I did mean to interrupt you. Obviously, but like, what do you? Right. Can you? Finish that thought. I'm curious.
I thought that was an interesting, and again, there's no intent in this movie, but a hyper-masculine reaction to an event like that of like, let's never talk about it. And it's not, I feel like it's not even implied of like, because this is a traumatic, horrible experience that will affect me for the rest of my life. But the implication was more because it was embarrassing for me or like because people would make fun of me for it. Like his intent in saying let's never talk about it again didn't seem connected to the trauma that there would be with an experience like that.
Well, you know what it's connected to, I now realize, is remember when Samuel Jackson and John Travolta are talking to the guys that they shoot in the beginning of the movie and he's like, is Marcellus Wallace your bitch? So then theoretically right. what this guy did... What the Peter Green character, the cop rapist, made him, quote unquote, his bitch, which is the worst thing to happen to a guy. Like, that's what
right.
happened there.
It's more of like a home, like it's a weird homophobic, like, I can't be the lesser.
The receiver of prostate pleasure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And as opposed to any. I mean, there's no commentary there, but it was like a very hyper-masculine move by a hyper-masculine character, but just thought worth mentioning. There's a lot
totally.
To unpack there.
Sure.
Because it's what is Marcellus like 3 years down the line after that experience?
He needs a lot of
therapy. He's like, this keeps happening to me.
I just think...
he's like, I'm struggling.
I gotta get a new job.
to me, it's like Quentin Tarantino being obsessed with like... revenge narratives where like Marcellus gets raped and then he gets to exact immediate revenge on his rapist by shooting his dick off and then just,
right.
we don't see what happens after that, but he
which
basically
is great.
Describes yeah
which is great
but then,
all for dicks getting
between,
shot
like,
off
between like Kill Bill, which is just straight up a revenge story, Django Unchained, Inglourious Bastards, these are all just like stories of like, let's just get revenge on these people. So I think it's I feel like that scene was put in there because he's like, I'm obsessed with people getting revenge for doing.
Well, and I also think that there's a little part in Quentin Tarantino's little weird lizard brain that's like, have people ever seen a man-on-man
exactly
rape scene
what
before?
I think that's exactly what
that's
it is.
That's what it felt like.
He's like, what's cool? He's like trying to do something memorable or cool. Like, no, I really think that's where he's coming from.
But that to me makes it so much worse. It's like, of like, oh, well, I've never seen this on screen. Let me just put it on screen. Let me not think about any of the ramifications or how a character would realistically deal with this. Let me just like... I haven't seen this. Here it is.
I would bet all my money that that's exactly
that
what it was.
That's what it is.
I don't
right.
think he is thought about it at all. Like, even in like the masculinity part, which is interesting because obviously he's a man, so he can't see what he's doing. Like, he doesn't know what he does, I guess.
Right.
But he's almost just like, no, I haven't seen this, so mathematically I should do that. Like, even with the masculinity part, I think, like, I would think he thinks he's a feminist because he did Kill Bill. You know what I mean? Mm. But he doesn't really.
Quentin Tarantino for sure thinks he's
right,
a feminist.
Right, because he's not even really like, think he's, yeah. I just think he watches movies all day long and isn't a person.
Yeah, but then when Harvey Weinstein is exposed as a predator, Quentin Tarantino's like, that sucks. Like, yeah. There's just, oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure he thinks he's a feminist.
Probably.
While Uma Thurman is threatening to murder Harvey Weinstein on Instagram.com.
A true feminist icon.
That's wild.
We're running out of time, so we should talk about whether or not the movie passes the Bechdel test.
It does.
It does. In one scene where Jody and Trudy, because we both know their names, mm-hmm. are talking about Jody's piercings.
Ooh, which introduces a new fun Bechdel asterisk to how we interpret it. Interpret the test on the podcast.
Meryl Streep?
Meryl Streep's interpretative. So a lot of times when we talk about the podcast, people will be like, oh, well, it's mainly about the Bechdel test, which it isn't. We talk about how women are portrayed, but new asterisk to the test because people ask about our particular interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when we see this scene that passes the Bechdel test, we do not yet know the names of the female characters, but we find out what their names are in the scene immediately following.
Mm-hmm.
For us, that's a pass.
That's a pass because
we find out what their names are. We don't know when the scene is happening, but we mm-hmm. learn pretty much right after.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we have to make all these exceptions or else no movies would pass the Bechdel test.
A little fun, nitpicky, yeah. new asterisk.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But yeah, we do find out their names. So, and they are talking. I don't think a man gets mentioned once in that conversation. They're just talking about Rosanna Arquette's various piercings all over her body.
Right. Just a real Quentin Tarantino, for some reason, didn't hit the
conversation. Although she does say, because she's talking about her tongue piercing, she's like, it's to make filleting better. So she's basically.
But filleting whom? Filleting whom?
Probably a man.
I think that is, you're not
is that,
a feminist icon.
Is that too heteronormative?
Yeah. I say, I don't know,
fellatio.
And therefore I'm a queer icon.
You're right, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So that's the one scene where it passes the back. I don't think any other scenes have two women even interacting.
Interact. There are sometimes two women in a scene, but they don't talk to each other.
Right, like in the restaurant or something like that, but yeah.
Right.
Let's rate the movie. On our nipple scale, where we rate the movie based on its portrayal of women, 0 to 5 nipple scale. This is going to be tricky because we see female characters who have personalities for once in
most
our fucking
lives. Most of them have names that I can think
yeah.
of.
Yeah. Of the ones that have speaking roles, I think almost all of them have names. And there are more than one woman in the movie. There's like up to 5 or 6 with speaking roles.
What a depressing.
But because this is a movie about men and their storylines, if there are women, they're sort of framed as the girlfriend or the wife, and they're not mm-hmm. really contributing that much to the story. I'm going to give it like a 2, I think. And again, it did bother me that like the two main plot points where a woman does something to significantly impact the direction the story takes is them making a mistake that has to be corrected by a man. So that
yes.
bugged me a lot. So yeah, it's going to be 2 nipples, and I'm going to give my nipples to Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hit us up, Meryl Streep.
Please.
Okay. Parts in this movie I wish Alfred Molina had perhaps had.
Of course.
I think he could have done Harvey Keitel's part very well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he could have done it as well as Harvey Keitel, and that's a lot because Alfred Molina is a master of his craft, as we know. I think that he could have done Bruce Willis's part, and it could have been a really fun breakout role for him. He could have also played Mia Wallace. Like, he's amazing.
Certainly.
I'm also going to give this movie 2 nipples for the reasons you described. It's interesting when you think about Quentin Tarantino's work as a whole, where this is his second hit after Reservoir Dogs, which is such a male movie
mm-hmm.
that we barely see a woman in the entire fucking thing. So it is interesting that he's gradually introducing women into his body of work. Pulp Fiction is not, you know, it's not
a woman's film. It's not a feminist film. Masterpiece.
It's an actor's film. It's a tone poem. It's a lot of things. There's a lot of horny depth in the film.
Oh, sure.
I think we can argue that there's a lot of horny tone poem elements to the film. But it's interesting that this is the movie where we see Quentin Tarantino start to realize, hey, what if I put a woman in the movie doing literally anything? Yeah, it sucks that women are either damseled or have basically no bearing on the plot.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give it 2 nippies, and I'm going to give those nippies to Esmeralda.
Oh, very nice.
Jake, what would you give?
So one thing I want to say is I think Jackie Brown would also be an interesting movie to do on your podcast because came right after, and it's all about, yeah. Anyway, I think 2 is pretty accurate. Yeah.
Did you just mansplain to us what movies we should do on our podcast?
I'm a man. Yeah. I warned you. When I emailed you, I said, even though I'm a dumb man, I'd like to do your podcast. I warned you ahead of time I was a man. You didn't know I was, and I am.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah, I just think it'd be interesting. Honestly, I just haven't seen Jackie Brown in a long time, and it's about Pam Grier, and it's like a very, it's her movie. So it's it'd be an interesting movie to do because it is the movie, I think, after this movie. So it would be interesting to see how much he changed. I wish that we had done both. Anyway, 2 I think is pretty fair. I mean, because also again, I mean, I love the movie. It, like even with all this stuff, watching it from this angle, which I never had before, I still love the movie. I think it's like super entertaining and ridiculous, and it's a relic from childhood. So it's kind of stuck there for me. But yeah, representation of women, I don't think you can argue. I think 2 is being generous.
Yeah.
Obviously, probably. Mia Wallace is like a pretty awesome character. And I do think you really remember her and she's cool as shit. But I don't think you can say that from a female perspective, this helps at all.
I think
in the end, if anything for gender, it is definitely been on the wrong side of history. But as a movie, I do love watching it. I have to admit, I think it's really fun.
Yeah. Jake, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Jake Weissman.
Wow. Where can people find you online?
@ Weissman Jake on Twitter. And that's it.
But check out Corporate.
Oh, yeah. Can we see Corporate?
Please watch Corporate on Comedy Central at 10 p.m. on January 17th. You can also watch the first 4 episodes right now for free on cc.com. I think you'll really like the show. It's good.
It's so good.
Hooray.
Vouched. Love it.
Thanks.
You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all the good stuff at BechtelCast, and go to our website, BechtelCast.com. You can subscribe to our Patreon.
That would be a blast for you if you did that.
That would be a blast for you. It would be a blast.
What a kick.
It helps us out with our production costs. It helps you out by getting even more Bechtelcast.
Wow. What a gift. What a time to be alive.
What a time.
2018.
Is the stuff for Patreon is just you two talking about men.
Yeah, it's just like a list
of our Google spreadsheet hit list.
Yeah, we don't. We should just do an episode where we list all of Alfred Molina's movies.
Alfred Molina. I'm going to start. That's a different podcast. Going through Alfred Molina's entire body of work with Alfred Molina. It's kind of just a thing for me and Alfred Molina. I'm sorry. No one can be included except the two of us.
I understand.
And it ends with us hooking up at the end of every episode.
Congratulations.
We hook up. Okay.
Cool.
Well, that was
thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.